All right, so this is a fabulously prompt bunch. Chris and I were just planning out the morning, and the thought is that we'll try to spend about an hour on complete, about an hour on CTD, then we'll have a short presentation by Rahul on what this whole taste testing scheme is about, and that'll lead into kind of a general discussion of everything. But then, everything in the universe. But then, the little twist here where it says Jens is in charge, so Jens Kaufmann back there, raise your hand, Jens, please. He looks so much like he wants to be in charge. Jens had a really good idea. He's quiet, but you know, deeply brilliant, okay? And last night at dinner, he said, you know, why don't we formalize these questions and discussion a little bit more? And so the thought is, I wrote down just one idea that I had that Kirsten and I were actually talking about a little bit last night. But as things come up over the morning, we'll take a break in the middle somewhere for these sumptuous cookies that we have hiding in the corner. People should talk about what we might want to continue discussing in a more focused way. And in particular, what we thought we would do is at lunchtime have at least three or more groups go off to kind of different tables and talk about whatever you want, but include in the discussion the particular question that might come up that might get written on the board here. So I don't know what these are, but just for example, one that could be here is this issue that keeps coming up of semantics and what exactly do we mean by cores and clumps and clouds and how do you calculate efficiencies, and that this is difficult because we don't have these definitions straight and we're not all talking about the same thing. And so anyway, that's just one.
Well, so what are we making the fact you put definitions in quotes?
I think the efficiencies are real and the definitions are arbitrary. I think I did that on purpose.
Okay.
I wasn't really thinking at the time, but I think subconsciously I did it on purpose. That doesn't make any sense. But anyway, okay. So let's just talk about complete. And so given what happened yesterday where I was trying not even to give a talk, but just to give an introduction, and I wound up standing there for a really long time, I thought I should give out this crib sheet here. Does everybody have one of these? And so this is just a list of all the papers that have anything to do with complete by members of the group, and then I tacked on at the end there for good measure some papers that Scott has written about TMC1C. Where's Scott? There he is. Thank you, Scott. Anyway, and Scott's going to talk about TMC1C, which is not officially part of complete tomorrow, but a lot of the work is related. And so I'm just going to start here and acknowledge that there are a very large number of people involved in complete. The people who are subtly in boldface are actually in the room, but many of the other people are well known to many of you. So we did, in fact, observe all of Perseus, Ophiuchus, and Serpens as planned, but somehow we started with Perseus in our analysis, and a large number of the papers on that list have to do with Perseus, and we're sort of getting to Ophiuchus and Serpens, and so the data are there for the taking, but we haven't really done a great deal of analysis in those regions, so I'm going to concentrate mostly on Perseus today. And so this is a composite that actually shows you some of the same information that Neil showed you yesterday. And what you see in the background is Barnard's image of Perseus from, it was taken in something like 1906. And it's interesting because it shows you what wide field photography can show you. And somebody mentioned the shell that we had quote unquote discovered yesterday. We didn't really discover it. It turns out if you looked at Barnard's image here, you would see this big H2 region, okay, which I'll show you later is surrounded by this dense shell. But anyway, we think that that's caused by a B star in here. And when I said quickly that the age was 500,000 years, that was just a guess yesterday. That was if it was, it's a lot of assumptions. We don't actually know the age of that shell. So anyway, I just want to apologize for that. But anyway, the green contours show you integrated intensity from 13CO. And some of you know that I don't like making integrated intensity maps and that I like using the kinematic information. And so I will certainly show you the CO data in different views later.
I'm looking at all the dark. I assume there must be mustard gas associated with a lot of the dark.
Yes, so there is.
That's an incomplete map.
Yes.
I hate to say that.
Yes, I have Neil to, you have Neil to blame. Okay, so this boundary that you see is
the Spitzer tack.
Okay, the Spitzer tack. Actually, well, we'll get into that later. But anyway, that's the boundary of the CTD data. And so the boundary of the complete survey was set by the boundary of the CTD. It actually goes, you can see it goes a little bit beyond.
But we tried to cover the AV equals 2 on Cambrensis' map, so I'm curious about that.
Which dark region?
Yeah, well, or crystals are printed down there, for example.
Yeah.
Is that AV greater than 2?
Scott, in the IRAS maps, I think it is, right?
Yeah, I can check.
Yeah, we have big maps of the whole region.
That's kind of disconnected in the
numbers. And I'll show you, there's actually... But no, there's a, we have maps, you know, that Scott made in the paper where he looked at, you know, what you should do to correct IRAS with extinction data and stuff. And those are the whole IRAS field. And so we can look later. Oh, yeah. No, now Joao has the extinction map that was in Naomi's paper that people are using was actually a subset of something that Joao and Marco are working on, which is even bigger. It's not, you know, as good as the pipe because of the background star distribution, but it's a pretty good map. So we can answer that question later. Okay, so importantly, I don't have time to go surf around for you, but you can go to the website, you can just click on the data link, and you can get anything you want. And in particular, there's this thing called an interactive coverage tool, and this is what happens when you just click off everything, and it just shows you the boundaries of particular surveys. And so to give you some sense, here's the SCUBA data, 850 microns. There's an H1 map. There's a millimeter map from Mambo, which is right. These are small maps. Sorry, you can see the key down here. N2H plus and CS are again small maps, subregions, near infrared imaging, C2D, the IRAC images, of course. 12CO and 13CO are the green boundary, and then the two mass extinction maps are shown here in the background. And so actually, that's right, we can answer your question right now, Neil. I don't have a scale, but that's what you're talking about right there. So maybe. But importantly, what you see is that there's full coverage in the kind of extinction map and thermal emission map and CO map, and that was what was called complete phase one. And so there's a paper summarizing all of that. And then there's this follow-up on individual interesting regions, mostly cores, which is part of phase two, and that involves deep infrared mapping and 30 meter maps and some very soon SMA data. And I'm going to show you just a little bit of that today. But I'll show you one little part, which is this ammonia survey that Eric Roslowski initiated. There's a special tool on the website where you can get a whole map of Perseus, and then you can click on a region that you're interested in, and then you can see where all the ammonia spectra were taken, and then you can click on an individual position and see the spectra, and then you can download the ASCII files for the spectra. You can also, of course, download the entire data set, but if you just want to look at a particular region, you can do that. And it's kind of fun, just as a little introduction here, to look at the context of all of this. And so this is a map that Scott made recently using actually the Spitzer data in this paper. There are maps combining 60 and 100 microns, and then 70 and 160 with all kinds of combinations of 60 and 100. And I've only taken out the Spitzer map here. And so here's a column density map, and I'm going to show you a lot of different ways to measure column density in a couple minutes. But here's one that is just from the 70 and 160 micron data. And Scott, you want to say anything more, like about how it was calibrated?
It's normalized so that the extinction that that I give from the 70-160 micron emission map matches what you would expect from the two mass near infrared derived extinction map. But that has something like 5 arc minute resolution, and this has the resolution of the 160 micron map, which is 40 arc seconds. So it's a sort of smooth, normalized, and then used the normalization is used to get the emissivity or opacity of the dust. The ratio of 70 and 160 gets a dust temperature.
Right.
So
there you go.
The temperature and humidity, you can get a column density.
So there's the temperature for the same region.
What are the units of the RAs?
It's decimal degrees.
Yeah. What did you do? What did you think they were? Just curious.
I thought you might have left off the hours.
No, it's a big map. Okay, so anyway, so that was the column density. That's the temperature, and then I'm going to show you them together in a second. There's the column density again. And then if you actually put them together using the same color scale, so that the reddish-orangey stuff was the temperature, and let me just remind you what it was. Oops. So the bright stuff is hot here, okay, and then the darker stuff is colder. And in the extinction map, the dark stuff is denser. So anything that appears black, okay, is very cold and very dense. Okay. So here, in the combined map, you can see those regions that Neil was showing us in terms of where the Bolocam defined cores and the scuba cores as well sit. And just for fun, I put on the ammonia survey on top of this, and all the little red circles show you the positions that were surveyed for ammonia. And so those were positions where either there was a Bolocam detection or some other reason to believe that there was a dense core there. And I should say that there's also another survey that Helen Kirk, Mario Tafaya, and Doug Johnstone did. Maybe Doug talked about it when he was here last week, in N2H+, that covers many of these positions, but not all of them. And so the data analysis for the ammonia has just begun. Phil's part of this survey, too, so I'm sure Phil will have what Phil would like, I think. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Phil, but not individual pointings. So these are single pointings of every core in ammonia. Okay. What I would like, and I think what Phil would like, is if we had maps of every core in ammonia. Okay.
I have a question. Why did you adopt this method instead of subtracting from the 160 emission that which is due to warm dust in the envelopes, the one which has been followed by
Haberger? Yeah, well, Scott did some separation of kinds of dust in the paper. I'm not showing that here, but do you want to say anything about that, Scott?
We did our best to try to remove the emission from the transiently heated very small grains. So it's not strictly the submicron emission method, some sort of, as best we could, submicron less the emission from the transiently heated grains. So we're trying to just use the emission from the big grains.
Yes, I understand, but why did you take this approach instead of subtracting from this ratio, the ratio that you would expect from dust temperature and transiently heated grains at 20 K or 25 K?
Yeah, that's certainly something we could have done.
You have not tried to compare.
I've made the maps, but I didn't have them. It's hard to get that in physical units. They want to subtract some flux and try to get a temperature column density. It's a little hard for me anyway. But if you think that's easier, you'd even like to talk to you about it.
Okay, that's conversation number one to be pursued later. Okay.
Let me just ask, Scott, when you made this correction for the transiently heated grains, how large a correction was that?
The transiently heated dust at 70 microns is the majority of the emission.
Right, we have, I should just say that I didn't include the maps at other wavelengths, but they don't look markedly different. And I was trying to show this just to give an idea of, we were talking about what are the environments of the cores. And so I was trying to show kind of what the general situation is in terms of where you find cores. And this is another plot from Scott's paper. I haven't shown all the plots that show no correlation whatsoever of gas temperature with dust temperature. So we have ammonia 1.1 and 2.2. This is GPT data. And you can determine a gas temperature. And then Scott has these dust temperatures from this various these analyses of the far infrared dust emission. And so you can compare at a particular point the gas temperature and the dust temperature. And there doesn't seem to be any.
So it's a random. What the gray red.
No, that's not, I'm not showing you a plot of what I just said. Now I'm going to tell you what's in this plot, okay? I'm not showing you a plot of no correlation, okay? I'm just telling you that there is no correlation, and you can see Scott's paper if you want to.
Before you leave that, though, yes. What density, I mean, you don't expect a correlation for densities, but at high density you do. So can you say what densities were you considering in this, looking at this correlation?
Well, so ammonia detection. We're only measuring line of sight hours. We're using column densities. So through the column densities measured in the Spitzer maps, which probably goes up to 15 or 20 magnitudes of visual extinction. Much correlation between
But you're going to have different biases. I mean, for the dust temperature, you're going to be dominated by the warmest.
Exactly. I mean, I'm going to show that in a minute.
The gas temperature, you're going to be dominated by the densest and probably.
And I actually think that that's a problem. And so I think that the gas temperatures that you get from ammonia are accurate, and that the dust temperatures that you get from Spitzer are not necessarily representative of the internal temperature of the core. And I'll get to that in a minute.
It's not a surprising result, but it's reasonably possible to calculate these ways.
So the only thing that's a little bit systematic here is that if you look at the temperature, so these are the kinetic temperatures. Remember, I said that they're not all 10K. Yesterday, I mentioned this, right? So here's 9K and here's 15K. And so there's a range of temperatures. Yes, it peaks around 10 or 11 Kelvin. The gray is all of the cores where 1-1 and 2-2 are detected. And then the red is the positions that are not in clusters, and the blue is positions that are in IC348 and NGC1333. So those are slightly warmer, as I think you would probably expect, but not by a lot, actually. Okay, so that was all by way of introduction of stuff that's been done very recently, and I had to put it in. But actually, in August, I made a promise that I would show you not just the first two steps in this list, but actually this five-course meal. So what I did in August at the meeting that some of you were at was I talked about column density, and I talked about self-gravity and dendrograms. But I didn't talk about cloud shine, which is this scattered light emission that you see when you go very deep in the near-infrared, and I'll talk about that some today. And I didn't explain this whole story that Mark was just alluding to about plane of the sky temperature maps not being able to account for line of sight temperature variations. And then I did not get into this subtle point of something that we've been discussing for the last couple days, which is how do you actually define what's a source and what's a core, and that you can actually bias your thought about how separated things are from each other or how centered things are, et cetera, by how you define the sources and the cores. And so talk about that a little today. So because not everybody was here in August, I thought I should go quickly through the things I already discussed there. And by the way, I'm not going to go 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to go something like 1, 4, 2, 5, 3 or something. It didn't make sense in the order that I told you in August. So here you go. Here's something that's pretty simple. This should be three maps that look essentially the same. Okay, so this is three column density maps of Perseus. The top one is based on two mass data and the NICER method, so this is an extinction map. This one is based on the 60 and 100 micron IRAS data calibrated so that on average the levels match the extinction map. And this one is based on 13 CO column density determined using the 12 CO to get the brightness temperature. So in other words, it's corrected for opacity and the temperature. And so what you see here, by the way, these black boxes are places where the extinction mapping and or the dust emission mapping are unreliable in the clusters. So this is NGC 1333 and this is IC348. These maps have all been smoothed to the same resolution, which is the low resolution of the extinction map, which is 5 arc minutes. Only pixels where 13 CO was detected with high signal to noise are included. And so there shouldn't be differences between these maps just because of sampling or because of noise. Okay. So do you see...
Lisa, can I ask about the 13 CO now, after Mark's comment about the dust, don't you have the same problem with the CO that if you are getting the temperature from 12 CO, that's from the surface of any structure?
No, it turns out that I would think so, but the 12 CO, when you look at the 12 CO map, Neil showed it yesterday, actually. I don't have it in my slides, but it doesn't look, I mean, it looks a little different, a little poofier than the 13 CO, but it's not like you can't see the internal structure at all. And so, you know, it's a fair guess, but it's true that if you could measure the temperature better, deeper in, you might be able to correct this map a little bit better. So it's
even if you see those structures, then there are structures which are very opaque in 12 CO,
right.
So I may get the temperature at the surface of that structure.
That is true. That is true. I mean, I'm going to say that this map is not a wonderful way to measure column density, and that is one reason. But it's not as bad as you would think. In other words, it's not like the 12 CO is some sort of blanket, you know, outside the 13 CO.
That's the 1-0 line?
Yeah.
Do those three maps have comparable spatial resolution?
Yes, they all have the same spatial. No, originally they had different spatial resolution. They've been smoothed so that they're all at the worst spatial resolution, which is 5 arc minutes. And so now I'm going to reveal what's wrong or what's right with each of these maps. And so in the extinction map here, so let me put it back. So there's the map. Let me just point out that the scale bar is the same in each one. So you can see already that there are differences because there's blue in the 13 CO and there's no blue in either of these. And, you know, here's B1, which is very prominent in the extinction and not as prominent in the emission. Okay, but so if you look at the extinction, this now is showing you the errors pixel by pixel in the extinction map. And so you can see that the error is correlated with the column density, which is what you would expect because there are fewer stars, and this is an extinction map that's made with constant resolution rather than constant signal to noise. However, the values of those errors are very small. So this top bar here is 0.4 magnitudes, and you'll notice that the top here is 12 magnitudes. So it's a very small error. So while the errors are correlated, they're very small. Okay. And then in the dust emission, what you see is this is the temperature structure now determined AD from IRAS data alone, which still has the small the transiently heated grain problem, but mostly in these cluster regions which have been removed. But what you see is here's the color bar going from about 15 degrees to 20-something degrees, and some of these cold regions over here are fine in terms of being, you know, looking like the molecular gas and looking like the extinction map. But what you see here is this domination by this big shell, and the interior of the shell is very hot, and then there's a region right around it that's been warmed as well. And so when you look at the column density map, you actually can see a little bit of the bias left from this shell, even though we have tried to correct from the temperature. I'm going to show you in detail what that does in a minute. So last but not least, we have the 13CO down there at the bottom. And if I take that map away, this now is a map of the opacity of 13CO, which is not small. Okay, so here's 0 and here's 2. All right, and that looks arguably exactly like the extinction map. Okay, so yes, you can try.
How do you determine the opacity?
How do we determine the opacity? So Jaime, you want to answer that?
So we assume the brightness, I mean, the excitation temperature from the close.
It's from light.
Yes.
I don't think I agree.
Yes, for the 12
CO. Yes.
So the brightness temperature, first you went to 0, gives you the excitation temperature.
Yes.
And gives you the surface.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But as Chris pointed out, this is not perfect because you're not really sampling exactly the same region. So, but it's better than what a lot of people do, which is to just take the integrated intensity of 13 CO and say that that's the column density. That I'll show you in a minute is even worse.
Why don't you use the millimeter map to get rid of all the temperature problems that are produced by the IRIS map?
Yes, we would love to if we could have a millimeter map that was fully sampled on that spatial scale.
You mean that there's not
a yes, no, I mean that if you tried to make a millimeter map, if I understand the question, you mean a millimeter map over this entire range, right? How do we do that?
I mean, Apex is now producing
yes. That would be fantastic. That would be great. And Jens has actually mentioned that.
And what about the beta reduction? I mean, you are transmitted with this kind of reduction.
You are losing large scale spectrum. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't care what instrument you're going to use.
Conversation number two to continue later. Okay, so let me just, I'm trying to go fast. The problem is this is interesting. All right, so in 2004, I should say that this was, the problem is it is interesting, I know you're laughing. This was all inspired by Eve Ostreicher asking this incredibly simple, what's the column density distribution in your maps question, okay? And little did we know the subtleties involved. Okay, so here's what you get from 2MAS in 2004. Here's what you get for 13CO if you don't correct using the 12CO for opacity. And here's what you got if you didn't calibrate the IRAS data that you would get straight from the catalogs with the extinction data. It turns out that's a relatively easy correction because it's just a matter of changing the opacity. This is a log down here, and so you change the coefficient and you can just slide this over. And so Scott did that in this paper a couple of years ago. Then if you do what Jaime was just talking about and correct the 13CO, you can make at least the distribution look like it's in the right place, even though it doesn't have the right shape. And so then you get to this point, okay, where you have these three shapes. And what's really funny is that some people look at this and they say, wow, that's a log normal. That's just what the turbulence simulations predict. That's so great. And other people look at it and go, oh, look, there's a little difference over here, and there's a little extra over here. Those people are mostly theorists. and that means something, and that's really interesting. And, you know, why is it like that? And so you can analyze this to death, okay? And I'll do it a little more in a second, but I just want to show you that the green histogram here is the best correction to the 13CO you can make, and the gray, interestingly enough, is what you would get if you just took the integrated intensity of 13CO.
Elizabeth?
Yeah.
When you selected the region where you took this, when you sampled the extension, did you make sure that you included the whole cloud? Could it be part of the cloud that's left out, which is why you were...
Oh, yes, no, that's a very good point, and we actually make that point in the paper. By taking the points where you only detect, where you have to detect 13CO, you are biasing yourself to losing some of this if you wanted to sample the kind of full inertial range of the cloud. But the thing is that these are all the same points in these three plots, right? So in other words, the fact of whether you get a log normal or not may be affected by the fact that you're not going to the lowest density. But the fact that they disagree is not affected by that. So then it gets even worse if you start thinking about the shell, okay? And so it's a little hard to see from where you are, but the light blue contour here is showing you this warm region at the outside of the shell, and the pink contour, it's the same in all the plots, is showing you the interior of the shell. And so if you look at the plots one by one of extinction measured these three different ways, you'll see that there's kind of a good correlation, except for these pink points and the blue points. And the pink ones are the hot interior of the shell, and the blue ones are the warm exterior of the shell. And I don't have time to go into it, but it turns out that they bias you in ways that you could predict because you're assuming a flux essentially as a product of column density and temperature, and if you get one wrong, you'll get the other one wrong systematically as the product. But what I did want to talk about here is the overall scatter in the gray points, and where does that come from? But I'll do that in a second. Instead, I just wanted to show you one more tribute to Eve, who, when I was here in August, was really curious about the regional variations in this plot. And we had made some plots of that a long time ago for a paper that Jaime worked on with Paola about abundance variations in these regions that I also am not talking about today, but I refer you to the literature if you want to see that. And instead, what we were just looking at is what is the variation in this plot? In other words, how log normal is this? And you'll notice, pick your favorite tracer, I like the blue one, that there are very significant variations from region to region. And so when we talk about taste testing and things like that later, this is the kind of thing where you'd actually want the simulations to predict, you know, for various subsamples, you know, how much variation would you get. And in fact, Enrique Vasquez did that in 1994 and got an amount of variance that's similar to that. He, however, is also the one that looks at this and goes, that's not a log normal. Okay. So, number four on the list, the plane of the sky temperature variations. So, we saw this plot a minute ago, and so now I want you to just ignore the emission from the shell. And instead, think about what the sources of the scatter are for these gray points. And so Scott has already written a paper about this, and in the paper it's considered that these could either be due to the fact that you're assuming one temperature for each column, but in fact there's a range of temperatures, and then you have this problem that you're biased by the warmest dust along the line of sight. Then there's what Edith mentioned, that you have a variable fraction of the emission from transiently heated grains. And then there's the other thing that's come up a couple times in the last couple days, that you can have variations in the dust property. So what Scott considered mostly in this paper was just number one here, what happens if you have variations in the dust temperature. And what he did was working with Tom Bethel, who has some MHD simulations. They took the MHD simulation and then they just ran a radiative transfer code and figured out what you would see at a variety of wavelengths. Okay. And this shows you what you would see for 60 to 100 microns in terms of the extinction you would derive from the emission versus the true column density, which is known from the simulation. And then as you go to longer and longer wavelength, the correlation gets better. But what's interesting is that when you add in, I should have covered these two up, but when you add in noise to that 60 to 100 micron one that's similar to the noise in these maps, you actually pretty much recover the scatter that's seen in the actual data. And so what you can say is that if you go all the way back to here, this scatter, okay, can be accounted for. I'm not saying it is, okay, but it can be mostly accounted for by just the fact that you have these line of sight temperature variations. Now, I'm going to go on to the next section, so if anybody has a question about this. Okay, it's Chris, Scott. Okay.
Well, on the previous graph where we had the 6100 is the broader scatter because of inaccuracies in the correction for the transiently heated grains?
No, there are no transiently heated grains. It's just that as you go to higher column densities, there's a wider range of temperatures. And so the the more
in the simulation,
column, the more column there, there is, the more shielding. And so most of the mass is shielded, and so you derive a higher temperature than you ought to in the high column density regions. And for a given flux, if your temperature is too high, your column density will be dropping, it will be too low. So in sort of low column density regions, that's on central column, everything's more or less at the same temperature. But the more sort of density regions you go through, the more you're being killed by the changes in the line of sight.
Why at really low AV did you get an offset?
Well, so it's normalized to have the smallest deviation overall for the map. And so to account for the underestimate at the high column, you have to overestimate at the low column.
It's a lever problem.
Listen, can you give us an idea of what's the range of temperatures you're talking about when you say when you put in temperature variations, you get an improved correlation, but are we talking a few degrees, are we talking 10 degrees?
Oh, I think it's more like the variation that you see in the plane of the sky. I mean, Scott can answer that because in other words, it's a calculated temperature, but I think it's like the temperature variations that you see in the plane of the sky, which you saw were from like 10 to 25 degrees. Is that about right?
That's right.
It's just as high as 25.
It does in the region of the shell. I mean, I can go all the way back and make a look.
Yeah, that's right. But in the simulation, though, it's just externally heated. There are no internal sources of heating.
Yeah, so if you
expect temperatures that high.
Right, so it's like 8 to 15 or something.
If you exclude the shell, as a matter of fact, in this map, what's shown here is just 15 to 18. So it's actually small range.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
Isothermal gas. Those are isothermal, so
they're reprocessed. Yes, it's a temperature that you would derive. It's a color temperature from those wavelengths.
So if you were working in non-isothermal simulations, you would get different results.
Good point.
How the
dust grains are at different temperatures in different regions of the simulation, and it varies both with position and also with grain size. So the smaller grains are warmer than the larger grains for any given volume element, and the grains closer to the outside of the simulation are warmer than.
How do you assign the temperature to the grains? Because the initial simulation, the original simulation is isothermal, as far as I know.
I think there's a density distribution. That's set by MHD turbulence. You have a certain amount of material in the volume. You drive it with turbulence for a while and freeze it. Then you irradiate it from some sort of interstellar radiation field that you adopt. And you let that come to some sort of equilibrium temperature. But it's not an isothermal temperature, but it is in equilibrium, assuming that all the emission will be.
Right, but what you're saying is it's not a self-consistent thing where there's actual heating and cooling and temperature.
Well, I think it may not be as bad as you think, because probably the places where you've got the most dust temperature variation, the dust and the gas aren't that well coupled. So what you care about from the standpoint of dynamics is the gas temperature, and that's probably varying by less than the dust temperature.
Mm-hmm. You've got photoelectric heating. It's also down very substantial. Right, about the same amount, actually, but not because of the coupling.
Okay. The point I think you made in Scott's thesis defense or something. Yeah, anyway, you're right. Anyway, all right, so let's see. Scattered light, cloud shine, right. And so what I had on my slide back in August is that it's a great way to improve the resolution of dust maps and potentially a big headache for JWST. I'm not going to talk about JWST very much, but remind me to at least mention it. So I've listed these here as complete bonuses. So what we were trying to do is, as part of complete phase two, we were trying to just make very deep near-infrared maps of some of these cores so that we could make extinction maps with higher resolution. Well, it turns out we got images that look like this. Okay, and there had been hints of stuff like this in the past, mostly in the optical, where you see these rims around globules and things like that. These images are the deepest, or they were at the time, I think they still are, the deepest wide field near infrared images of regions with cores. This is 14 arc minutes on a side. And I should just say that the black that you see here, sort of you see this pattern of bright and then black, ignore the black. okay, because they were taken in a way where you didn't know that this extended emission was going to be there, and the chopping does not go far enough outside the field to actually get rid of that, so you get this little bit of shadowing. So the overall structure that you see is real, but the shadowing that you see is not real, so ignore that for the moment. And so this is the L1448 region of Perseus, and this is the L1451 region of Perseus. And we made a very simple model of what that emission was, saying that you just take the ambient interstellar radiation field and you scatter it off of pretty standard dust. And this is the region that I mentioned yesterday that Phil picked out as looking like a round globule when he first saw these images. And so we chose that region and said, let's look at a hemisphere and pretend that you have a 1 over r squared density profile. What would you get in terms of what the map would look like? And so this is what you get as azimuthally averaged data, and this is what you get from a 1 over r squared model. And this is just a cut across it. This is the actual data, and this is for the model. So this was not meant as a fit of this particular core. This was just meant as a plausibility argument for this is what's giving you these colors. And so what then happened was Paolo and colleagues took this quite seriously, and they went and took one of their simulations and saw what you would get if you did analysis of the JH and K scattered light that you would get out of the simulation. And if you model just the H-band flux and not the color, this is a plot of the true column density and the recovered column density based on fitting the scattered light. So you wouldn't do so well. Okay, this is if you can't see the axis. This is a ratio of 1 going straight across here, and this is 1.4, and then this is 0.6 down here. And if instead you look at the color, as we did in the previous simple example, this is the map that you actually recover. So I'll flash it back and forth. And the only places where they're very different are where you see these kind of white spots. So that's the difference between the recovered map and the simulated map that are in the highest, most opaque, density, most opaque regions. And so overall, it's a little hard to see. I was annoyed with Paolo for just plotting all these points on top of each other. But if you look at the distribution, where it's not just a big green blob, there's about a 20% scatter either way in what you recover. So if you believed, okay, that you could invert these kind of scattered light images, you could potentially map the column density with the resolution of these images, which is like an arc a second.
But don't you need to know the source of illumination?
That is a good point. So you'll notice right here, that's why I put this image back on, you'll notice there's a lot of asymmetry in these images, okay? And in fact, in Perseus, NGC 1333 is like way up here, okay, compared to where these cores are. And so there is an asymmetric source of illumination. And so the question is, we haven't done, this is exactly the kind of taste testing like experiments that we would like to do. In other words, how much does it matter? You know, how much you change the illumination in terms of whether you'll get out the right column density. We don't know. But yes, Paolo did this with a uniform illumination.
And how does that compare to the same kind of data observed in the visible by that, what is the name of the survey?
Jill Knapp
was working on that.
Who, sorry?
Jill Knapp.
Jill Knapp was working on which survey?
I forgot the name. It's a wide field.
Sloan survey? Sloan?
Yes.
Oh. Oh, that one. Yeah, I've heard of that one. Okay, yeah. Sloan doesn't go really deep enough to do this in the optical. There are some regions where they did actually deeper images, and I've been talking to Doug Finkbeiner about those regions. Do you remember, were you there for this conversation, Jaime? Which regions? I think there's a very deep map of Taurus.
Yeah,
actually. Is that what it is? Yeah.
It's not very deep.
Well, deeper than regular Sloan, right? But anyway, so for this region, I don't know of, there is a map of quote unquote Perseus, but it's not this part of Perseus, the one that Doug showed.
It's the Perseus cluster.
Right. So, but good question. I mean, a very deep optical imaging. Right, so I'll mention. So for JWST, you understand, forget about all of our interest in molecular cloud structure. You understand that a very narrow observation at very deep near-infrared magnitudes is going to be affected by this, even through very low-density clouds out of the plane. And you don't a priori know what the color is, okay? And so it's even hard, even if you made a wide-field image, to figure out pixel by pixel what the correction should be to the color of some extragalactic object because of this foreground.
what you're saying is the JWST is going to become the preferential tool for studying molecular class. Forget all this.
You said that, Mark. I didn't say that. Okay. So this is a very complicated paper that would take me like at least 30 minutes to explain properly, but I put this slide in here just for Neil. And I think since Paul Harvey was the referee of this paper, and we thanked him, you probably know all about this. But this is what happens if you do the kind of analysis that Neil was talking about yesterday, trying to separate young stars from galaxies, but you actually use the very deep near-infrared images that I was showing you a minute ago. And so just to, this is like plot number 14 or something in the paper, but I just want to show you this one thing here, which is if you take the H minus K and the K minus 4.5, okay, so this is the Spitzer 4.5, this purple region is a region that, yes, Jurgensen in his paper said should contain only YSOs. And in fact, it's littered with galaxies. And so we can actually determine that those are galaxies from the near-infrared imaging. Okay, so you can actually see that they're galaxies. And so the way in which they're galaxies, that's what the subtlety of all these different symbols are. Some of them are extended and some of them just have galactic colors. And so, again, I'll refer you to this paper, which I think is on AstroPH now. Yeah, it is. And you can actually see that most of the galaxies that you see are at redshifts of 1 and in some cases 2. And so these are very highly redshifted. At least it used to be very, now it's moderately highly redshifted galaxies. And you can imagine that if you did have something like JWST, you start getting a huge litter of these kind of sources. But oh, I forgot to tell you the good news. This says Hunting Galaxies 2 and 4 Extinction is the title of the paper. So 4 Extinction is that you can actually use the galaxies. So you can model the colors of the galaxies. And just like you do NICER using the sort of standard near-infrared colors of the background stars, you can do that for the galaxies as well. And you can use the galaxies to improve your extinction mapping. And so in this paper.
Why is that? Because the stars, you expect to have a uniform set of colors, but the galaxies and then redshift have a range of colors, and then I start redshifting.
Yeah, it turns out that actually in the particular colors that are observed, the range isn't that big compared to the shift that you get due to the extinction. And so, and the other thing is that the galaxies for the same colors are systematically fainter than the stars, and so you can separate them that way. And so you can actually, I refer you to the other 15 figures of the paper, but you, that is a problem, and the range is bigger than it is for stars, but you can still use them. So, and Jonathan actually compares what the extinction maps look like using galaxies and not using galaxies, and not only do they improve slightly using galaxies, but they're also systematically biased if you don't include the effects of the galaxies because you think that the sources that are galaxies are stars, and since the galaxies are systematically fainter, you overestimate the extinction to those particular pixels. Okay, so we're up to number 2. Okay, I have 15 minutes left. This is actually number 3 on my list. Okay, all right. Self-gravity matters on a large range of scales at identifiable locations. Okay, so this is kind of the most fun thing that I've done in a long time. And what this leads up to is this dendrogram analysis that I talked about briefly in August. And that's a way to use a particular algorithm to identify hierarchical structure. But before I show you that, I'm just going to show you kind of complete velocity richness. So let me get out of the way here. So this is just a regular channel map of the 13CO superimposed on the map that you saw before. So you see I'm playing with the slider there at the bottom. And so as I slide that back and forth, you're going to different ranges of line of sight velocity. So while this is very interesting and it shows you things like what the gradients are in the cloud, it doesn't really show you, at least it doesn't show me, even though I stared at this for many hours, the kind of overall picture of what does the structure of the cloud look like in position velocity space. So instead, we've been having fun with some software. And yes, I know we can't really spin Perseus around in the sky, but let me show it to you without the background. Okay, so if you look at this now, let me play with this in the same way. This is now a map of Perseus where if I put it back here, that's just the plane of the sky view, okay? And then going into the screen is velocity, okay? So redshifted is away from you. And what you can see is that there are a lot of very interesting velocity structures in Perseus. And in particular, if I can, why don't I look here? Put this back like that, you can see this. You see this here? Okay, so it turns out if you watch that, as I turn the cloud around, that is something that people have traditionally thought is a separate cloud along the line of sight to Perseus. But in fact, it's actually tenuously connected all the way around in velocity space. And it unfortunately crosses right in front of NGC 1333. Mm-hmm. So here it is. You can follow this, okay, and then try to... Okay, and so it winds up being this stuff here. Okay, and that big yellow blob in the background is NGC 1333. Okay, so this whole thing is actually at a very different velocity. And so all of the spectra in that region are actually contaminated by this arc. Quite different. If you look at the, hang on. Why can't I make this go backwards? I want to go to the previous slide. Stop. I have. Okay, so if you look at it this way and you know what you're looking for, oh, not that one. No, not that one. Okay, here. And you know what you're looking for. Okay. Does this have, oh, the units are obscured at the bottom. But anyway, here is... that's the mean velocity, right? And then actually it's so different that when Naomi made this movie originally, she cut off the velocities. You start to see stuff here, okay, and so see this ridge here? But it actually continues on. And it's about 3 or 4 kilometers per second different. So it's very different. Okay. So anyway, you can also actually, turns out, see evidence for that other shell, which is in here. But I don't have time right now. We can play with this later. And I have the real software on the computer. And so showing movies of it doesn't really do it justice. We can actually show you the real data and answer questions like Phil's. So, but what I wanted to talk about was self-gravity. So let me just pick one region, which is this L1448 region that we've been focusing on recently. And the light green contours are again showing you just the integrated intensity. Now you're losing the velocity information in this picture of 13CO. These little billiard balls are going to turn out to be important features in position-position velocity space, although you can't really tell that from this picture other than number one here. By the way, these orange things that you see are big outflows within L1448. The reason that this yellow square is here is because that's the region of the very deep near-infrared image, and then the rest of this, I believe, is just a two-mass image to fill in the rest of the space of the 13CO analysis. So what does that look like if you think about position-position velocity space? And so you saw on the other slide it says position-position velocity space is not the same as position-position-position space. Okay, we all know that, but the problem is when you start looking at 3D images like that, you kind of go, oh, that's what the cloud looks like in 3D. And so it's not, right? But on the other hand, if something is very separated from something else in velocity, it probably is a different thing, okay? So let's see what this looks like. So this here is what the internal structure of this region looks like using this dendrogram algorithm that I'm going to describe in a minute. But very importantly, the algorithm that you're more familiar with, ClumpFind, does this to exactly the same region. Okay? And so ClumpFind doesn't have a way to account for hierarchical structure. And so what I said yesterday is that in 2D ClumpFind, where you have things like the pipe and you have isolated blobs, it's a perfectly fine way of identifying structure. In 3D, where you have very crowded regions, I mean, in 3D, where you have very empty regions, it's okay, but in 3D, where you have very full regions, it does this bad thing where it tries to fill in all the space with these little chaffy things, and it also obviously can't account for what is intrinsically a hierarchical structure. So what is the hierarchical structure? So I'm going to tell you that, and then I'm also going to tell you what this does to the clump mass function in a minute.
Alisa, I would like to say one point. People have not used ClumpFind in star forming regions because it would be really meaningless.
They have.
They
have.
Because I'm not a defensor of ClumpFind, but it clearly, if you have outflows and shows and you use ClumpFind, you can find anything.
It's even worse than that, but yes. But unfortunately, they have. So, yeah. Okay, so We won't name names, but I can later if you'd like. Anyway, so how does this dendrogram algorithm work? Okay, so this is a 1D analogy to what's actually going on in the 3D box that I showed you a minute ago. So here you see isosurfaces, okay? Imagine in 1D that those isosurfaces are just lines going across an intensity profile. And then imagine that I have this test level, and I have this black thing as the profile, and I drop the test level down. Okay, every time I get to a local maximum, I mark that as a local maximum. And then when I get to another local maximum, here it is. And then when I get to this dip here, where I don't know which local maximum I'm in, then we call that a merger point, which in this simple example corresponds to a local minimum.
Does it handle London profiles where you don't get a local maximum?
Yes, because what you do is what's shown in gray here is a number of test levels. And in fact, the number of test contour levels are very, very tiny. And so the only problem that you have is noise. And so you actually have to decimate the data some to smooth it, essentially, to get rid of little noise spikes, because otherwise you would find features every time you drop down by, you know, one RMS. So,
have to do some sort of Gaussian deconvolution?
No, no, importantly, no. Okay, so, right. And so there's no, the only, you know, free parameters, essentially, are the spacing of the levels, okay? And the level that you assume for the noise.
And the zero level.
Right, I said in the zero level, right, which you assume to be the RMS. Okay. So anyway, you do this, and then you can build up this kind of tree diagram where the things at the top are called leaves, and then the things connecting the leaves are branches, and et cetera. And then you finally get down to the whole cloud itself, which you can call a trunk. Okay. And so if you do that for this region in L1448, let me take off the 2D view and show you the 3D view. You now see why these billiard balls are important. So this is, again, velocity going into the page, and this is position in this square here. And then the colors over here, this is the, oh, how do you make a tree diagram of something that's three-dimensional? Okay, so in this simple example, it's easy to see what the tree means. Okay, it's taken me the better part of 6 months to kind of mathematically straighten this out in my head, so if you can straighten it out right now, I'm really, you know, inadequate. But what you do is you think of this as a 1D analog of this 3D situation. And so the actual 3D tree that would go with this is essentially impossible to draw because you need four dimensions to draw it, the same way I needed two dimensions to draw it for a one-dimensional profile. And so what we do is actually just sort the branches so that you can make a 2D display. And so the x-axis here means nothing. So only the hierarchy means something. What's important is that the purple here corresponds to the purple surfaces. The pink corresponds to the pink surfaces that you can see kind of connecting the purple. And then the green is just showing you all of the emission in here. And the cute thing is that because we know the column densities and the velocity structure and obviously the extent in position velocity space for these things, we can calculate a virial parameter for any one of those. Essentially, for any one of these contour levels, you can calculate a virial parameter. So if you do that, you can then say, as you go down in this tree, what would be quote-unquote bound? Okay, there's no external pressure, no magnetic field, so it's just internal kinetic pressure and gravity. And what would not be? And so the yellow stuff is actually showing you all of the places where you would assume that this gas is bound. Okay, and so the billiard balls mark places where there's some self-gravitating leaf, okay? So that's what those four positions are. And in fact, all of the already formed young stars are associated with one, and then I think it's this clump and this clump have some suspicious submillimeter sources, and this doesn't have anything as far as we know, okay?
Can you tell how you deal with the velocity? Because it's unlikely that when you have a beautiful branch in space, you have a similar
yes.
Velocity.
Good question. The thing that's hard is to figure out how much mass to assign to each one of these components. And so what happens?
And velocity.
Right. So if this is velocity going along here, and this is intensity, and we'll go back to this 1D analogy. The problem is, if I'm going to say that this is a thing, okay, I have three choices. I can either say that the mass associated with it is just that, I can say that it's just this, okay, and include this plus this, okay, or I could extrapolate down to the baseline, okay, and say that it's everything plus the envelope. And so we actually show in, there's two papers, there's a, this is from a Nature paper that's been submitted, and then there's a longer APJ paper about the method, and we actually show the difference between these three things. This will produce nothing that's self-gravitating, which probably is wrong given that there are stars forming there, okay? And then this method where you extrapolate and this method where you just go down to the baseline give you pretty much the same answer. Yeah.
But that, the definition of self-gravitating might be, have different people have different opinion on how to.
Absolutely. So we put self-gravitating in quotes throughout the paper.
Do you use the Geary parameter?
Yes.
Extension of the Geary equation.
We actually reference your work in the paper, and we talk about what would happen if you included external pressure. But we don't have a way to do that easily right now. I'm almost finished. I'm sorry, I'm trying. Yes, yes?
Yeah, I'm just wondering how you deal with
how we deal with radiative transfer effects?
Indeed, it seems to me that you are trying to do what 3D spectroscopy would do. I mean, 3D chemistry would do. Having bias traces, you can really deal with.
Oh, I have to show you a hidden slide now. Okay.
Deal with relative transfer, because how can you assert that you don't have self-absorption into a line? And I didn't understand how you did it.
The data that I'm showing you now are obviously just data, right? And so whatever radiative transfer has gone on is what went on in nature. But let me just show you something that I was going to skip, but I will now show you. And so this is the data that I just showed you. That's the Klumpfein rendition. This is Eric Roslowski's re-observation of Paolo Padoan and Mika Givalia's Perseus. Aki Nordlund probably talked about this when he was here. They made this map that's supposed to be like a 13CO map of Perseus based on the complete data from their simulation, where they did the radiative transfer as best they could and the molecular excitation. And so this is what you get for a 13CO map, which is, has a radiative transfer, has noise added, and has the sampling of the FCRAO telescope added to it. And it looks not completely dissimilar to the data. What's interesting is that if you run Klumpfein on both of them, even though this has the same noise added to it than this, you actually get a much more uniform set of clumps for the simulation. And so it's interesting that Klumpfein itself might be kind of a useful statistic. The dendrogram of this looks very significantly different. I don't have that in this set of slides. Very significantly different, the tree diagram, than this. And in fact, has way too much self-gravitating structure. And so, boy, I have just a couple more things I wanted to say. So this is now Klumpfein, again, run on L1448. This shows you what happens when you create mass spectra. This is now Jaime Pineda's work. And this shows you what happens when you create mass spectra. Klumpfein has two important free parameters. One is the step size. So Klumpfein, you contour down in three dimensions from the peaks, and you break everything into these pieces. And so obviously, the different step sizes go to the question Dick was asking a little while ago about when you merge things into other things. And then there's also a threshold level that you don't want to go below, because otherwise you're making noise into clumps. And so this is the effect of varying the threshold level, the top line, the middle line, and the bottom line. And then this is showing you what happens for different step sizes. The pink area shows you an unphysical regime where the clumps have less than a thermal line width or are below the noise level. So you see what I meant when I said this, I think it was yesterday, that a lot of times this break that you see in the so-called clump mass function from Klumpfein may in fact not be real, okay? And this is a summary that I really like that Jaime made, where you look at the same data set, and the three different lines show you, as a function of step size here, what would you get for that power law exponent in the clump mass function for these different thresholds. And so you see the threshold doesn't matter very much. What matters is the step size. And what's interesting, this is what Jaime told us yesterday, the range that you can get is anywhere from saltpeter down here to 1.6, which is the kind of clump mass function that, say, Elizabeth Latta got originally in 1991. So this is disturbing to me. And then the last thing I wanted to say is about the stellar distribution, or the source distribution. And so here again is a map of all of Perseus and a little zoom of L1448. So the red sources, you can see it better in the zoom down here, the red are Melissa's Bolcam sources that she'll tell you about more in a minute, and the blue are the scuba peaks that were detected in the survey that was done both by Jenny Hatchell and Helen Kirk and Doug Johnstone. And you can see there's some correspondence, but even the scuba and the Bolcam don't agree source by source. You'll see that the scuba ones are all associated with actual embedded stars. Okay, the orange things are the positions of things that we would actually call protostars for one region or reason or another. This just shows you a high-resolution ammonium, N2H plus map from ERAM on top of the 13CO in the background, so that you can see what Neil was talking about yesterday, that the 13CO is kind of fluffy compared to the compactness of the N2H plus. And by the way, the ammonia would look very similar, as does the millimeter dust emission. So yes, we wish we had millimeter dust emission maps on this scale. And so depending on how you define your gas or how you define your sources, you can get, even here where you have, you know, 1 millimeter and 850 microns, you know, which are cores and which are sources? You know, I don't know, right? And so the last slide I have here is some work that is in progress that Jens Kaufmann is doing, where he's using the kind of visualization software that we have to try to put a lot of these data sets together and figure out what's going on in position velocity space. So in this particular example, the red are those so-called self-gravitating objects from 13CO. Again, velocity is going into the page. This is the plane of the sky. The yellow shows you from the ammonia survey the velocity extent of the positions that were observed. And then the plane on the back here is Melissa's Bolcam emission. And if I could turn on the software here, I could slide that plane through. And you could actually see, you know, where the sources are and what ammonia they're associated with and what 13CO they're associated with. And so, you know, some of the interesting questions are like, do you see ammonia cores centered in self-gravitating 13CO objects, or do you see them outside? You know, are any of the sources completely outside of all of the molecular emission, et cetera? And so we're just starting to be able to do this. And so this is the kind of thing that you'll see in the next few years. And so the software that we have doesn't let you just make pictures. You can actually then, once you find the interesting regions, extract them and do things like measure offsets and velocity extent. And our big focus in the next couple of years with all of this is to understand the kinematics within these regions, because you've seen that a lot of what I showed you before was all about the density structure. But I personally am really curious about all of these velocity offsets, or lack thereof. And I shall stop there. Okay. Great. So should we take a break, or should we go on to Melissa?
We should probably take a little break.
How about a little break? We have some cookies here. I'll what should I do? I'll just put them on the table. It's not exactly elegant, but